This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This year's midterm elections ended with a sigh of relief for defenders of democracy. There seems to have been no violence and relatively few races that were challenged by the losers. Extremism fared poorly. But a significant number of election deniers did win seats in the House of Representatives, and states are still chipping away at voting rights. And Donald Trump will continue to do everything he can to undermine faith in the process. So today we're going to talk about where democracy stands right now. Later in the show, we'll hear from the authors of the very cheerfully named bestseller, How Democracies Die. And we'll start with J. Michael Luttig, who's a retired judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals. Luttig is quite a prominent figure in legal circles. He's close to everyone from Clarence Thomas to William Barr, and he was mentioned as a Supreme Court pick during the George W. Bush administration. But Luttig finds himself at odds now with the Republican Party. And in his testimony to the January 6th committee, he harshly condemned all efforts to cast doubt on the 2020 election.
Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. I don't speak those words lightly.
So this well-established conservative is now allied with the Democratic Party on a legal case of enormous consequence. Judge Luttig is co-counsel in Moore versus Harper, which is appearing in front of the Supreme Court on December 7th. That case hinges on what is known as the independent state legislature's theory. That was the justification that Trump and his team gave for their effort to overturn the presidential election. So the stakes for that case could not be higher. Judge Luttig, you told our writer, Jane Mayer, that you signed on as co-counsel because you regard Moore versus Harper as, without question, the most significant case in the history of our nation for American democracy. What exactly is this case, and why is it, as you put it, legally the whole ballgame?
The reason that Moore versus Harper is the most important case since the founding for American democracy is this. At issue in the case is something called the independent state legislature theory of constitutional interpretation. Whether the state Supreme Courts are authorized to review redistricting decisions under the state constitutions and invalidate those redistricting decisions where they are unlawful. But to cut to the chase, I think I would say this. Gerrymandering of congressional districts is one of the most nettlesome and important political issue of our times. And the independent state legislature theory that is being argued by the petitioners in this, in Moore versus Harper, that would allow for partisan gerrymandering to go unchecked from now on. It would, in theory, allow the state legislatures to appoint electoral slates who would vote for a presidential candidate who did not win the popular vote in the states, and transmit those votes to Congress to be counted on January 6th in exactly the same way that Donald Trump and his supporters attempted to do in 2020.
Now, this all comes with an enormous amount of political context. You are a figure, I think it's fair to say, on the conservative end of the legal establishment. You clerk for Antonin Scalia and Warren Burger. You helped Clarence Thomas prepare for his extremely dramatic confrontation with the Senate Judiciary Committee. You have a close relationship with the Chief Justice Roberts. And on January 5th, a lawyer for Mike Pence came to you for advice about what Vice President Pence should do in the face of the President of the United States pressuring Pence to, in essence, reverse the election come the next day. That came to you as a surprise. What was your reaction to that? Tell me that story.
Well, in short, Richard Cullen, who was then outside counsel to the vice president and had been for a couple of years, and who's a dear friend of mine, called me first on the night of January 4th and asked me what I knew about John Eastman. John Eastman was a clerk of mine 25 years ago. And I told, Richard, John was a constitutional scholar, an academic, a brilliant individual. I told him that, and I said, well, why are you asking? And Richard said, you don't know, do you? And I said, no. And he said, well, John is advising the president and the vice president that the vice president has the authority to overturn the election by rejecting state electors' votes from some of the swing states and or delay the counting of the vote on January 6th in order to give swing states opportunities to submit alternative electoral slates. So I said, no, I didn't know that. I said, you can tell the vice president that I said he has no such authority and he has no choice but to accept the electoral votes as they have been transmitted to Congress. And Richard said, he knows that that's your view. And I said, okay, I'm available to help in any way that I can. And we hung up. My wife said, well, what was that? And I told her, and she said something like, oh my God, you have to do something about this now. You have to stop this. And I said, well, I really have no role here whatsoever, and there's nothing I can possibly do.
Was it your immediate sense that John Eastman had a sincere legal belief that this was possible, legal and right, or that he was part of a plot, to be perfectly honest, as it's been put by the January 6th committee, part of an attempt at a coup d'etat?
I thought, knowing John, that there had to be something to what he was saying. But I knew at that point, from my own knowledge of all the issues, there was nothing there that would warrant advice to the President of the United States of America, who was at that point attempting to overturn a presidential election. But did I think that John must be thinking something? Yes. And it turns out that he was. But once I knew what he was thinking, I categorically rejected it as a basis for advising the vice president. But in any event, so my wife and I went to bed that night with her pleading with me to do something, and I saying to her repeatedly, there was nothing I could do. So then the next morning, the phone rang, and it was Richard Cullen. this is the morning of January 5th, and he calls and he says, you know, Judge, what are you doing? And I said, I'm just having my coffee. And he says, look, we have to do something, you know, immediately. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, the vice president is meeting for lunch with the president to tell him that he's not going to yield to the president's demands the next day. And Richard said, we need to get your voice out to the country explaining that the vice president doesn't have the authority either to award the presidency to Donald Trump or even to delay the counting of the votes. And that set in motion, you know, me scurrying around trying to figure out what it even meant for me to get my voice out to the country. Mm-hmm. I was retired. I didn't even have a fax machine or a box of stationery.
I've got to assume that you were not that active on Twitter.
It never even crossed my mind because I didn't know how to tweet. But at the end of the day, I ended up tweeting what the country knows now to be the tweet that the vice president included in his letter to the nation on the morning of January 6th as he was on his way to the Capitol.
For those who don't recall, the tweet read, "The only responsibility and power of the vice president under the Constitution is to faithfully count the Electoral College votes as they have been cast." Now, I've got to ask, did you have a hard time setting up a Twitter account?
Oh, my gosh. My very first tweet took 5 hours. I literally asked five of the country's leading Supreme Court reporters to help me. And at that, I believe I ended up printing out what I wanted to say in Word, taking a snapshot of it and posting a picture of that Word document. So
the Republic is hanging in the balance and you're having a hell of a time trying to figure out how to be Paul Revere and set up a Twitter account. That's a little nerve-wracking.
It was more nerve-wracking than the actual drafting of the words that went into the tweet, David.
What was your reaction when you heard that the Supreme Court had agreed to consider the independent legislature theory of John Eastman's in the case of Moore versus Harper? Four justices of the Supreme Court signed on to hear this case. Why do you think the Supreme Court has agreed to consider what really can be described as a fringe legal theory?
Well, the Supreme Court takes many cases in which it, as in this context, affirms the decision below. So the fact that the court took it means nothing beyond the fact that the court understands that this issue is of great national importance and that it has an obligation to decide the case.
You strike me as someone who does not think that the alarm about the state of American democracy is overstated. Tell me what you think has happened in the conservative movement and the Republican Party. As somebody who's now retired and free to speak about this, what happened that things shifted to such an alarming degree that we're in the state we're in?
Yes, I'm deeply concerned that American democracy, you know, today is on a knife's edge, and there's no dispute as to why it is either. Because you had an incumbent president who was intent on overturning a presidential election and tried. And almost succeeded. The Constitution doesn't contemplate and therefore does not provide for something like was attempted on January 6th. So suppose the vice president had gone along and announced in the joint session that Donald Trump was elected the next president of the United States. There is no entity of government and no official of government including the Supreme Court of the United States, who would have known what to do.
You know, we've just come through a midterm election where election deniers were often defeated at the polls, and some people are responding by saying, problem solved. Do you have that level of hope? I just watched an interview on public television with Bill Barr, in which he couldn't have been more critical of Donald Trump, and obviously hopes that he will be eliminated as a candidate. But when pressed to say, would you refuse to vote for Trump if it came to that in the general election? He said, well, it would have to depend on who the opponent is. He didn't rule out another term for Trump, even though he's so obviously repelled by Trump, even though he resigned at the very end. That to me is very, very curious.
Bill's a political figure, just like all of the other political figures and the political leaders in our country today. Our politicians and our political leaders have failed us. That's the way I see it. And in this instance, they failed us, you know, at the very end by refusing to speak up.
Well, how do you, if I can interrupt, I'm sorry,
yeah.
How do you analyze that? Or is it so wonderful being in power that you sell your soul for it? I don't quite understand it. I just don't, for the life of me, forgive my naivete, I do not understand why at this late date.
It is embarrassing, but our political leaders will cling to power at any cost, and they will say anything necessary in order to cling to their own power. They actually don't even try to rationalize it, which in itself is disturbing, but revealing. That's abdication of official obligation and responsibility of the highest order. So that brings me then to the heart of the question you just implicitly asked, which is, you know, where do I see things today? I've said very recently on the heels of the midterm elections that American democracy was victorious in that election primarily because the election deniers were resoundingly defeated at the polls. Now, of course, that statement predated the former president's announcement that he would run for the presidency again in 2024. And so, you know, unless he tells us differently, you know, his intent is to carry forward with his plan to overturn the 2024 election if it becomes necessary. But I've been sounding the alarm as to the Electoral Count Act reform also. I've been advising both the Senate and the House to increase the percentage of each House necessary to sustain an objection that is made. Right now, literally, it only takes one member of each House to object to a state electoral slate and send it into the joint session for decision on the objection. Well, we saw, you know, how pernicious that provision is. All it takes is one senator, one member of the House, and of course, we had that in 2020.
Judge Luttig, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you again for having me.
J. Michael Luttig is a retired judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals, and he's co-counsel in the upcoming Supreme Court case, Moore v. Harper. Oral arguments will begin in the case next week. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and we're talking today about the state of our democracy, and specifically whether democracy is really any safer today than it was a month ago before the midterm elections. A few years back, I and a lot of other people read a book called How Democracies Die, a bestseller in 2018. It was written by two professors of government at Harvard University, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. They spent decades researching the breakdown of democracy in a variety of countries. Now, gentlemen, your book was published in the middle of the Trump administration, the darkest days of it. Now, Trump seems to be, let's not count him till he's out, but Trump seems to be on the fade. And election deniers like Doug Mastriano and Carrie Lake, they all lost. And in Brazil, Bolsonaro was voted out of power. So what? Mission accomplished? Democracy is healthy? You're feeling great? Let's start with you, Steve.
No, not at all. The underlying fundamentals that lead us to be concerned about American democracy have not changed. Levels of polarization have not changed. Not only does Trump continue to be a major figure in the Republican Party, but the Republican Party continues to be a very radicalized extremist force from the bottom up. And we've yet to see evidence that that has changed dramatically. So the political party as a whole, that party has not reconsidered its ties to violent extremist groups. That party has not reconsidered its acceptance of all sorts of violent rhetoric and discourse prior to, during, and after the January 6th insurrection. So as far as I'm concerned, we have not seen enough to conclude that American democracy is safe.
Right now, we're seeing the standing of Donald Trump in the Republican Party. And I want to put a pin in this and say 6 months from now, a year from now, we could see him still very much on the scene, if not even winning the nomination. But right now, you are seeing at least part of the establishment right-wing media distance itself from Donald Trump.
We keep losing and losing and losing. And the fact of the matter is the reason we're losing is because Donald Trump has put himself before everybody else.
If Donald Trump is on the fade, what is left behind? In other words, is democracy still imperiled if Trumpism and a radicalized Republican Party is still very much in place? If the governor of Florida becomes the standard bearer of the Republican Party instead of Trump? Daniel, could you answer that?
Yeah, I think one important point is to note why people are separating from Trump. It's because they think he's a loser. They don't think it's the route to power. So the moment that he's perceived to be a possible route to power, people will latch back onto him. So there's been no kind of principled turn against Trumpism. And so I think that's significant because it suggests that it's opportunistic. And what opportunism means is that the moment it looks like there's a possibility that Trump might be the guy, to ride to power, this could happen again. So that's one point. A second point is that even without Trump, the party itself has changed. I mean, there's no question about it. You don't have people coming out and saying the 2020 election was a legitimate election. Joe Biden was legitimately elected. At best, you get people evading the question, dodging it, trying to change the topic. And as long as you have that condition, it's hard to take a kind of turn back to democracy, the Republican Party, seriously.
Tell me about the governor of Florida, Governor DeSantis. What does he represent to you in terms of being similar to Trump or some kind of difference? What does that represent as a potential future scenario?
He's a smart guy, and I think he realized that if he's ever going to make it in national politics, if he's going to be the Republican presidential candidate, it's very clear to Ron DeSantis that there's no going back to the era of Mitt Romney. That if he's going to be the Republican candidate in the future, whether it's 2024 or 2028, he has to do it with MAGA voters. He has to win Trump's voters. And so if he competes with Trump, he may have to compete to Trump's right. That says something about the future of the Republican Party. But I'm paying a close attention to what DeSantis does do, or at least sometimes pretends to do, with the machinery of government. He's a guy who's made it clear to his base that he's willing to use the machinery of government to punish rivals, critics, and other folks that his constituents don't like. And that's really the essence of authoritarianism, being willing to use the state as a weapon, the machinery of government, legal institutions, as a weapon against your rivals and your opponents is the essence of authoritarianism. And so going after businesses who are critical of his policies, pushing legislation to criminalize protest, making a big fuss about arresting voters who may have unwittingly violated electoral laws. A lot of this stuff has been more for show than for action, but it shows a political figure willing to engage in what is really at root authoritarian behavior. And I don't want to push this too far, but he's the closest thing I've seen in American politics yet to Viktor Orban.
Right, the prime minister of Hungary for many years.
Yeah, Viktor Orban is less nakedly authoritarian than Donald Trump, but he's a very effective authoritarian.
Is DeSantis an authoritarian or a potential authoritarian in your view?
I worry that he is, yes. Based on his behavior in Florida.
Be specific.
The attack on Disney for its political views. Mm-hmm.
For Disney to come out and put a statement and say that the bill should have never passed and that they are going to actively work to repeal it, I think one was fundamentally dishonest, but two, I think that crossed the line.
Legislation essentially criminalizing protests in some cases.
It is the strongest anti-rioting, pro-law enforcement piece of legislation in the country.
What is effectively a poll tax in the face of large-scale referendum victory in which felons were granted the franchise, making it extremely difficult, placing a financial burden on former felons to be able to go back and vote.
Florida felons will need to pay all fines, restitution, and legal fees before they will be able to vote. A judge issued that order today, reversing a lower court's judge's decision that allowed felons to vote regardless of their financial obligations. That move could be critical for our state come election time.
Yeah, this is pretty authoritarian behavior.
When you look at the range of leaders of the Republican Party, how do you distinguish between right-wing conservatism and authoritarianism?
I think there's two really minimal kind of criteria that one needs to recognize. One is accepting election results. Do you accept legitimate election results or not? And when I say accepting legitimate election results, this doesn't mean remaining silent when asked, you know, did somebody win? And you sort of, again, avoid the question. You have to unambiguously say the election was free and fair. My rival beat me. Number two, the degree to which you're willing to condone or condemn violence, especially in the use of violence to gain or hold on to political office. And so if you have people who essentially are willing to, again, evade the question, avoid the question, then they're essentially allowing this kind of behavior to happen. And both violence and election denial are at the heart of what authoritarianism is. So you can have Republicans who are very conservative on all sorts of dimensions, but who accept those two basic premises of a political order, you know, those two benchmarks are very easy to identify and apply to Donald Trump. But I think, you know, what's striking about, I think, Ron DeSantis is, as far as I know, he hasn't really unambiguously said that Joe Biden won the election. So to me, that's a red flag.
How do you see in this picture the role of Tucker Carlson? There are people that I talk with who believe that at some point he is going to cross over into electoral politics. What kind of role does he play now, and could he play?
I mean, that's obviously speculation, but here is a guy who has really perfected the Trumpist discourse and done so in a much more thoughtful and articulate and often compelling way than Trump himself. He's a guy who has openly embraced what I find to be a terrifying theory of this so-called great replacement theory.
I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it, that's true.
Which I think is, in some sense, at the core of the fear that drives rank-and-file Republicanism today. Rank-and-file Republicans, more than anything else, not all of them, many of them, feel like the country they grew up in is being taken away from them. They feel like they're not just, you know, at risk of losing elections. They feel like they're losing their country. And Tucker Carlson, perhaps more than anybody else in this country, has articulated that fear over and over and over again to followers. So he's obviously a very, very successful media entrepreneur. There are many, many media entrepreneurs going back to Father Coughlin who have built up a massive base and have been rumored, or there's been triggering speculation about their entry into politics. Fewer of them have actually entered into politics, but I think it's certainly possible.
Earlier in this program, we talked about the Supreme Court case Moore versus Harper, which has to do with state legislatures and their control of the electoral process. How worried are you guys about the decision that could come out of that case?
It's pretty worrisome. Daniel and I, How Democracies Die, spent a lot of time talking about this phenomenon of constitutional hardball, which is exploiting gaps in the Constitution or in the letter of the law to subvert the spirit of the law. But at the core is this idea, this historically fringe idea that the Constitution empowers legislatures to essentially overrule state constitutions, state Supreme Courts, and governors in determining the electoral rules of the game in that state. So it's possible there's a world in which a Supreme Court ruling could legitimate or legalize a coordinated effort by, in many cases, gerrymandered state legislatures to overrule the popular vote in particular states.
I'm talking with Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, the authors of How Democracies Die. Stephen, you said that polarization is one of the pillars of our current situation. But we've seen times before when the country is highly polarized, elections extremely close. Why is polarization as such an anti-democratic element in our national scene?
Look, polarization as such is not necessarily threatening to democracy. In fact, it's important for democracy. Voters need choices. Modern democracy is based on electorates being able to choose options of government. And so a certain amount of polarization is really healthy and important for democracy. Voters need to know that they have choices. Otherwise, they lose interest in and faith in democracy. So I don't have a problem with a moderate amount of polarization. What we know from history and including U.S. history is that extreme polarization, when we begin to view our rivals as an existential threat, when their worldview and their political program is so foreign or so threatening that we view the other side, a victory by the other side, as an existential threat, that creates incentives to begin to play dirty, to use all the tools on the table to defeat your rivals. And that very quickly throws the country into crisis.
Daniel, let's talk about the nature of American polarization and the political parties that we do have. over and over again, one hears the analysis now that what characterizes the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, what distinguishes them so much, is the Democratic Party, and I don't mean this as a compliment to one and as a rip on the other, simply as a description, but the Democratic Party is, with great exceptions and so on, is the party of people who are educated as opposed to the people in the Republican Party who are not. Not because it's their fault. Do you think that's fair? You read this in David Brooks and a lot of other commentators.
I don't think that's the central and most relevant divide. I mean, certainly there's an element of it that you have lots of well-educated people in the Republican Party. The Republican Party for a long time was the party of the wealthy, and the Democratic Party was the party of the non-wealthy. So these divisions kind of cut across parties. I think the most important division has to do with race, ethnicity, religion, and way of life. And a lot of this is overlaid then with geography. I mean, to put it very simply, the Democratic Party is a party of educated, you're right, urban city dwellers and a range of non-white segments of the electorate, predominantly are in the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is overwhelmingly, despite recent trends with, you know, Latino voters in Florida at the edges and some parts of Texas and so on, the Republican Party is overwhelmingly a white party and much more religious. And the reason this is so polarizing is that whites, for most of American history, have sat atop all of our country's social hierarchies. And in many ways, segments of the Republican electorate resent, not all Republicans, but many Republican voters resent or are fearful of the changes taking place. And as long as this kind of cultural divide divides the parties, it's extremely dangerous because these cultural divisions are sources of identity, and identity are often hard to negotiate. And so this leads to extreme conflict.
Daniel, I think it's almost axiomatic that when we look back at the presidency of Joe Biden, it's going to be how effectively or not did he combat the effects of the Trump era.
From the very beginning, nothing has been guaranteed about democracy in America. Every generation has had to defend it, protect it, preserve it, choose it. For that's what democracy is. It's a choice, a decision of the people, by the people, and for the people. The issue couldn't be clearer in my view. We, the people, must decide whether we'll have fair and free elections.
What kind of marks do you give Biden on the very broad and essential issue of democracy and its restoration?
I take him at his word that this was a high priority. I think there was sort of two theories going in as to how to deal with it. One was to immediately address the voting rights issues and to try to really push a series of institutional reforms through, including, you know, trying to reenact sort of elements of the Voting Rights Act that have been dismantled over the years. And kind of change the rules, try to change the rules of the game to democratize our democracy. The second approach was to focus on improving the economy, protecting the economy. We have to remember in 2021, as we're coming out of COVID, the kind of sense that there was an economic crisis on our hands was very real. And so the idea of focusing on infrastructure and building up the economy, and I think they followed that second path. That's pretty clear. They really chose to prioritize the economy over institutional reform. You know, I think in retrospect, that probably was the right way to go. But I do think that it's absolutely critical to, you know, lend his legitimacy and his popularity as far as it exists to try to make reforms, including reforms, you know, things that he doesn't have any control over, like the Senate filibuster, you know, putting pressure on Democrats to kind of reinstate elements of the Voting Rights Act, to change the Electoral Count Act. But I think until those kinds of reforms are undertaken, we're going to continue to be very vulnerable to the kinds of problems we've been facing all along.
Do you think that we're going to teeter on this brink of democracy, no democracy, or authoritarian tendencies versus their opposite for a very long time to come?
I mean, I think one way of thinking about it is that, you know, we have a fever. Our country has a fever, and it kind of flares up at moments, and at moments it seems to be kind of under control, but there's a set of underlying illnesses, a set of underlying fundamentals. And so we get through these moments where it seems like, aha, the crisis has been avoided, but the underlying ailments are still there. And so that as a result of that, you know, that we run the risk of every several years feeling like our democracy is in crisis, that depending, you know, that our future hinges on the outcome of a single election. And you can't really live in a functioning democracy if you feel like each election is a national emergency, because what it means is that we're not confronting the major problems confronting our society, climate change, inequality, et cetera, because we're so focused on trying to deal with the momentary crisis. And so I think as long as this underlying fever is there, as long as these underlying fundamentals are there, we risk every few years confronting the same challenge.
Stephen?
I think as long as the Republican Party continues to be an extremist force, and as long as our political institutions overrepresent and amplify that party, protect what is in effect an authoritarian force, we're going to be vulnerable. I think the opposition, the small d Democratic opposition, the Democratic Party, it is far too strong for us to slide into outright autocracy like Russia or even Hungary. It's much more likely that we will slide in and out of crisis and have a slide from sort of dysfunctional, weak democracy into, in the worst case, possibly a stolen election or very soft, unstable authoritarianism. But the main characteristic, as long as these underlying fundamentals of an extremist party and institutions that protect and amplify that party, the dominant characteristic of our politics is going to be sliding in and out of crisis.
Isn't one of the essential aspects of this whole problem, as you look at the Republican Party, the problem of extraordinary hypocrisy? In other words, Chris Christie, who was a great Trump enabler, who desperately wanted to be his attorney general, chief of staff, who helped his campaign, who spoke up for Trump over and over and over again, now puts himself forward as a potential presidential candidate, as an anti-Trumpist, as a spokesman for democracy. One could easily say the same of DeSantis and others who were underwritten by Trump or great supporters of Trump and now see political advantage in doing the opposite. So how does the Republican Party cleanse itself of this if that indeed is something that they want to do?
I think if there's genuine breaks from Trump for those who previously were aligned with him, that's to be welcomed and encouraged. I mean, I'm all for that kind of hypocrisy. You know, that's a healthy – I mean, that's, you know, in a sense, democratic politics is about seeking out opportunities. And if people perceive it as in their interests to break from Trump and then also have a genuine transformation along the way – and the reason the genuine transformation is important is because if it's just about opportunism, then the moment the opportunity comes back to go the other direction, you then clip your direction and go the other way. So I think this kind of hypocrisy is not the worst thing in the world, and that's actually what's necessary, is that – you know, there needs to be a willingness to admit that there were mistakes made. And the problem is that's very hard to do that. I mean, just psychologically, I think it's hard for people who in public took these very public stances to now go back on that. But I think the health of our democracy really hinges on that.
That's Stephen Levitsky along with Daniel Ziblatt. And they're the co-authors of How Democracies Die, and they're working on a follow-up book called Tyranny of the Minority, which is expected to come out next year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, not long ago, Susan Orlean was on the program reading an obituary, and it was for a tiger. Her essay was published in her column Afterward, where she pays tribute to recently departed people, animals, and even sometimes things. We're featuring some of those pieces on the program as we head toward the end of the year, and here's Susan Orlean.
There was much rending of garments and high-pitched wailing at the news that Choco Taco was no more. The frozen novelty, vanilla ice cream, peanuts, fudge, and milk chocolate conveyed in a taco-shaped cone, was killed off when its manufacturer, Unilever, decided to simplify its product line. The announcement was cool and clinical. Owing to supply chain challenges and a, quote, unprecedented spike in demand for its offerings, Unilever was discontinuing a few items so that it could marshal its manufacturing efforts on a smaller set of tasty Klondike treats. Alas, the world of junk food is cruel. One day, you're enjoying your trolley roadkill gummy candy, or your Wonka Oompas, or your Altoid Sours, or your Doritos guacamole. Not just enjoying, but developing a specific, urgent craving for them. And the next day, without so much as a fare thee well, they're gone. Sometimes the product is a commercial bomb, and its termination is hardly a surprise. Here's to you, McAfrica, Coca-Cola Black, Cheetos Lip Balm, or Ida Funky Fries. And sometimes, in the grocery business, for example, it's more a matter of product overpopulation. This is often the case with Trader Joe's, which is famous for having products materialize and dematerialize constantly. Unlike Unilever, which didn't flinch when issuing the death notice for Choco Tacos, Trader Joe's acknowledges the pain one might experience when discovering that chili lime mayonnaise has left this realm, writing, "We understand that it can be disappointing, devastating even. We are Trader Joe's customers too, after all." It is elemental in the human condition to rail against the indignity of mortality. Although we have always raged against the dying of the light, perhaps during these feel-bad times, losing a simple delight feels especially unsettling. Take, for instance, the case of Costco's Combo Pizza, a nearly 700-calorie per slice pepperoni, sausage, green pepper, onion, and black olive concoction that was a favorite in the chain's food courts for many years. In 2020, Costco, determining that its menu needed to be streamlined, quietly sent the combo pizza to its grave. Social media was aflame with outrage. Believing there was a chance to roll away the stone, an individual calling herself Toby O started a petition on change.org titled, "Bring Back the Combo Pizza to Costco Food Courts." It stated that the pizza is a delectable combination of meaty goodness and vegetable crunchiness. The combo pizza ignites a party of tremendous flavor in the mouths of millions of Costco membership holders. The termination is not only saddening, but total madness and just straight up wrong. At last count, more than 12,000 people had signed the petition, but Costco hasn't budged. And what of the Choco Taco? There was such an outpouring at the announcement of its demise, and so much triggering of desire. Countless stories featuring beauty shots of pristine Choco Tacos, a bit of condensation glistening on their chocolate shells, a Pavlovian urge to have one, even if you've never wanted one, just because you knew you might never get one. A cynic might wonder if it was a little too tidy, a sort of staged Andy Kaufman-style event that brought more attention and declarations of love than any other ice cream novelty could even dream of. How viral to have an offer from the internet entrepreneur Alexis Ohanian to buy Choco Taco from Unilever, to save it from its fate. "I can't let this happen," Ohanian declared on Twitter. "Not to America, not on my watch." The suspicion that this was a fake death was so acute that Choco Taco itself had to deny it on Klondike's official Twitter feed, writing, "I want to address the rumors. I'm really being discontinued. It's not a PR stunt." But in a coy aside, the account suggested that everyone, quote, "stay tuned." In the meantime, you can buy one of the last of the dying breed on eBay for a mere $6,942. "Own a truly rare item," the seller states. "With the loss of Choco Taco," he adds, "it's a tough time to be alive."
Choco Taco, rest in peace. Susan Orlean's essay was published in The New Yorker in August, and you can read her column afterward at newyorker.com. Now, in a few days, I'm going to interview Ina Garten, the great barefoot contessa of Food Network fame. And if you have a question you are dying to ask Ina about a holiday favorite you can't seem to crack or some recipe that's just a little out of your comfort zone, send it to us. And make sure to tell us your name and where you're writing from. And I'll put some of your questions to Ina Garten when we meet. Send us those questions by emailing newyorkerradio@wnyc.org. That's newyorkerradio, all one word, at wnyc.org. Or find us on Instagram and respond to our Instagram story at New Yorker Mag. And we'll see what Ina has to say. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.